Detective Lori Howard was once told the only way the case of the unidentified woman she was working on would be solved would be through the grace of God. This gave her the name Grace Doe, and she was known by this for years until she was finally identified as Shauna Garber. A few weeks ago, investigators made public new information, filling in gaps of Shauna's story, including an update to her name, and revealing what happened to her the night she was murdered. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we will be joined by guest reader Terrell Rothery.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, this is a special episode because we have our first case update.
I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, it's something that I knew was going to happen because when I wrote Doe, like when I was in the process of writing it, like I didn't think most of those cases would ever be solved. And really, like the landscape since then has changed dramatically. And so I knew at some point we would be able to offer a case update.
Yeah. And I think actually when you think about it, almost every episode has been a case update of some sort.
Yeah.
Compared to your book.
Compared to the book. Yeah.
So, but this is our first case update compared to the podcast.
Right. And actually a pretty recent episode. So we did an episode on Shauna Garber, and this is an update to that. And, you know, some listeners reached out and asked us if we were going to do an update because they'd seen the news about it. And I was like, already on it.
Which is super cool. We really are at that point where we're starting to hear from our first listeners, a little bit of feedback. And I love it so much.
Everyone has been so sweet and wonderful. And I like hearing from them and what cases resonated with them and, you know, their perspectives on what we're doing and their thanks for what we're doing. So that's been a really nice and heartwarming moment.
Yeah. And we've even gotten some requests and things, and that's just so cool too.
Yes. And we are open to requests. So we have covered solved cases, and this is, you know, an update to a solved case. We, though, typically do unsolved, missing, and unidentified persons cases. So to call attention to them. So if there's a woman's story that hasn't gotten enough attention, please feel free to reach out to us and let us know. Now, one of the cases that I wasn't certain would ever be solved was the case of an unidentified woman found in Missouri in 1990. And we covered this case extensively in episode 25. But if you haven't had a chance to listen to that one yet, here's a brief summary of what we covered. On December 2nd, 1990, a couple was walking and picking up trash in rural McDonald County, Missouri, when they came across the remains of a woman near an abandoned farmhouse. Her head had been covered with what was described at the time as rags and wrapped with coaxial cable, which is the cable, again, that is used for cable television transmission. Of particular note, she was bound in what was described specifically as hogtied with six different types of ropes and cables. One of these was paracord, and a type of paracord that was military grade and sold exclusively to the military at that time. They were able to tell that she was a young woman and had been sexually assaulted during the attack. With no information to go on, her identity and killer were unknown. In 2008, a detective from McDonald County, Lori Howard, began working on her case. Lori's friend had told her that this woman would only be identified through the grace of God, and this name stuck. She became known as Grace Doe. Now, it's through Detective Lori Howard's efforts that the identification of Grace Doe moves forward. She locates Grace Doe's remains that had been misplaced, gets an artistic rendering done of her, and is supportive of the efforts to identify her through investigative genetic genealogy. And on March 29th, 2021, it was announced that Grace Doe was a woman named Shauna Garber. Shauna was 22 when she went missing, and little is known about her childhood because she did spend her childhood and young adulthood in foster care. They did locate her immediate family members, in particular her brother and half-sister, who had been looking for her for years. In that episode, there were two main questions that still haunted Shauna's family members and investigators, and those were, what happened to Shauna, and who killed her? And some of the answers to those questions have been found. So this is our first case update to update us on what they have discovered since that time.
Okay, I'm sure pretty much everybody's anxious to hear what happened to her, because there were so many scenarios of what it could have been. And there was even like rumors that it could have been like the BTK killer, which we were, is it necessary to say killer?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in that case you're saying
is killer, it redundant?
Killer twice, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so the BTK
guy?
Person? Which we didn't really think that it was him, but it was like along the lines of that with the tying thing.
Yeah, so at the time that we made this episode, you know, like a few months before, they had like really, there's been a lot of publicity about her case and a lot of conversations happening. And his name had been mentioned in there. So we did present it as one of the avenues that had been discussed. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in this update. And so it's something that like I felt like we needed to talk about because it was a conversation that was happening. But investigators then were like, no.
Okay.
No.
And so spoiler alert, it's probably not him.
It is definitely not.
It is definitely not him. So let's see who it is.
Okay. So on March 21st, 2024, so that's a full 3 years after announcing her identification, Detectives Lori Howard and Rhonda Wise held a press conference with this new information about Shauna's case. Detective Howard said this case wasn't solved by sitting behind a computer. She says it was through statements, sources, witnesses, pounding the ground, and driving people absolutely insane for 30 years. We finally have the answers that we needed. I'm going to go through this in chronological order, starting with what we have found out about her life. But first, I wanted to apologize for misspelling Shauna's name. We've now learned that it is spelled S-H-A-U-N-A. We've also learned that her birth name was Shauna Beth Garber, but her name had been changed and she went by Shauna Robin Harvey.
Do we know why her name was changed?
So some point she was adopted and it sounds like it was changed during that time. She was returned to foster care, though. So
the Harveys are her adopted family?
Yeah. I mean, like, when my parents adopted at least one of my brothers, they did go through a name change for him as part of the process of, like, feeling like they participated in naming them. It's not always done, but in her case, it looks like it was. So since this is a case update, I'm not going to go through everything that was in that initial episode, but we do need some information for context here. What was revealed about Shauna's past history in this press conference is heartbreaking. Shauna was born on March 1st, 1968 in Iola, Kansas, in a car. That's not the heartbreaking part. Plenty of people are born in a car.
A lot of people are born in cars.
Yeah. We also know, and we covered in the last episode, that when Shauna was three, her mother poured lighter fluid on Shauna and set her on fire. After this, the children were sent to foster care. Her brother says that the last time he saw her was in March 1974. He was 2 years older than her, but their birthdays were only 2 days apart. So social workers threw them a birthday party. At this point, they'd only been in foster care for a few months.
Is there more heartbreaking parts coming up? Because yeah, that's already a really rough start.
It is.
Yeah, she's the same age as my sister, so I'm feeling like
extra
protective.
While her brother was adopted by a family he says treated him like their own, Shauna had a rougher time of it. Her half-sister was able to speak with Shauna's first foster family. They said that Shauna's face had been severely burned in the attack, and that when she entered their home, she was wearing diapers. She would often wet herself out of fear. At some point, Shauna was adopted, but by the time she was six, it looks like she was back in foster care. She stayed in foster homes until she eventually aged out of the system. Now, Shauna's brother obviously turned 18 before her, and he left her two letters with caseworkers, and these were to be given to Shauna. One should have been given immediately, and that expressed that he loved her, and one was to be given when she turned 18. The second letter contained his contact information and his offer for Shauna to live with him after she turned 18. It looks like neither of those letters were ever delivered. So it's unlikely that Shauna knew that her family members were looking for her.
That is really sad.
Yeah. Which is why, of her childhood, Detective Howard says, she was only 22 years old, and I don't think she ever had an ounce of joy in her life.
It's so sad that she had somebody who loved her and wanted her, and she just didn't get that letter.
Yeah. Because there was, like, very few ways for him to be able to get in contact with her.
Yeah.
So instead of reuniting with her family when she turned 18, she left Kansas and headed to the Veneta and Claremore area of Oklahoma. Her sister believes that Shauna may have been looking for her first foster parents with whom she'd had a good relationship. Now, it's unclear if she ever made contact, but at some point she ends up in a halfway house in this area of Oklahoma. Now, this halfway house had an agreement to provide labor to Hudson Foods in Missouri. Hudson Foods had several Missouri-based locations, and one was in Noel, Missouri, which is in McDonald County. This, as a reminder, is the county where Shauna was found murdered, so I'm guessing this is the location she was sent to. This facility was responsible for processing chickens. So Shauna and the others would be transported to Hudson Foods and back to Oklahoma in a van. And to emphasize this, this is not a short distance away. Noel is about an hour from Veneta and an hour and a half from Claremore. It's not clear where the halfway house was specifically located between these two towns, but that's a long haul daily. Now, Hudson was having trouble finding labor, and so they were finding it where they could. They'd taken over this plant in the 1970s, and over the next 30 years, consumption of chicken in the United States had nearly doubled. Do you remember all the, like, eat white meat?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's the white meat, and then wasn't there the other white meat, and it was pork?
Yes. Yes.
Such a weird obsession with white meat.
Right. And it was really just like a marketing strategy to just get us to eat more chicken. And it worked. Yeah,
it did.
So this town, though, it can't sustain the additional labor needs at this plant. It's such a small town. That's likely why they formed a partnership with this halfway house. Later in the 90s and 2000s, it's clear they rely heavily on immigrant labor. And in our source notes on our website, you can find a lengthier Washington Post article on what happens to these immigrants when Tyson, which had acquired Hudson Foods later on, decides to pull out of this small town. But anyway, as we talked in our episode on the disappearance of Pa Pow, slaughterhouses and processing plants are dangerous and intense jobs. It sounds like Shauna didn't last long here. Instead of taking the van back to the halfway house, it looks like she took off walking from the plant towards an unincorporated village called Ginger Blue. This is on Highway 59, and it seems like the only thing there really is the Ginger Blue Resort.
That sounds so random. Like the Ginger Blue Resort. It sounds like tropical or exotic. And it's just like, what is it?
Like this small, like little boop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had to like process that over and over when I kept on seeing Ginger Blue. I was like, what?
It's weird, like a right?
Uptown name. I don't know.
Okay. We'll go with it.
Now, the information that comes next is from witnesses, and I'll cover how those witnesses shared this information later. But Shauna is walking along this road when she is picked up by her killer. Her killer's name has been released, but as is our practice, I'm not using it here. She was picked up on Halloween night. In our first episode, I talked about how a boy had told his parents he had seen her body on November 3rd, but his parents didn't believe him when he shared this information with them. What I didn't share in that episode, because I couldn't find direct sources for it, and just saw mention it in various places online, was that he had heard a woman scream on Halloween night, and that's the reason he went to investigate a few days later.
So everything this kid was saying is true.
Yes. So he becomes this, like, pretty strong witness to what's happening here.
Okay.
So this information that was released in the press conference corroborates that story.
Imagine being that little boy and not being listened to.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And then finding out later that you were right?
Right, yeah.
It's going to have you questioning everything.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually, like, when I taught at college, I used to share this part of an episode of This American Life. It's, like, the shark story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about, like, being young and not being believed about something very important.
I listened to that one.
Yeah.
After you talked about it.
Right?
E. Yeah. Let's believe kids.
Oh, I should also mention to listeners that I did have a student pass out once listening to that episode of This American Life. So, like, please listen responsibly. Anyway, back to Shauna. Her killer was driving an old black Ford pickup truck. This was described as a work truck that didn't have a muffler, so it was quite loud. This was not his vehicle, but he was driving it when he picked her up from alongside the road. Witness accounts put this vehicle in the location her body was found. There's witness testimony that heard the truck at the farmhouse that night and heard two doors being closed. Now, there is a witness to her murder. and this witness shared that Shauna was raped and bound. One of the details that often sticks with people about Shauna's case is that she was bound with so many different types of cables and ties. And Vanessa, I know that's something that you commented on as well in our episode.
Yeah, it just seemed a little much.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be back in a moment.
Ohio is a land of mystery. From missing shipwrecks and lost treasure beneath her surface to strange phenomena slicing through her skies. From myths that have evolved around historic events and people to the unsolved murders and disappearances that keep her communities wondering what happened. Find Ohio Mysteries on your favorite podcast app and let's explore the inexplicable. OhioMysteries.com.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.
Investigators now believe that most of those materials came from the back of the truck and that largely they were what was there and what was convenient. There was a coaxial cable, which is used for cable television again, and it's believed that this came from the Ginger Blue Resort as they'd recently installed cable television. This coaxial cable was used to secure a white towel. So previously they'd been talking about rags around her head. And they believe that this also came from the resort since the resort used white towels. A napkin was found near her body as well. And this was also attributed to the resort.
So lots of ties to this resort at this point.
Yes. Now, Shauna's body isn't found until December, which does mean that a lot of decomposition happened between her murder and discovery. Initially, one of the theories was that she had died by strangulation. This was a suggestion because there were no apparent bullet or knife wounds. But because of the decomposition of her soft tissue, this wasn't a certainty. What investigators have now revealed through their investigation and supported by witness statements is that during the attack, Shauna started screaming. Because they were in a valley, her killer was worried that she would be heard, particularly because her screams could echo through the valley. To keep her quiet, he injected Shauna with meth, so much meth that it caused an overdose, and she died due to this. He left her there by the abandoned farmhouse, still tied up.
So was his intention to kill her?
I mean, that's maybe not necessarily clear, but the brutality of this attack with all the...
Was it pointing towards...
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine he thought of some other outcome and he didn't want her to be heard, you know. Yeah. I can't imagine that he was thinking of a different possibility for this.
Just didn't end the way he was intending it to.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do we know about her killer?
So her killer is basically when he kidnaps and murders her. He is in his late 20s. By 1990, he'd already had a criminal record, which included first-degree assault and drug trafficking. In his life, he ended up serving time in Missouri and was on probation in Oklahoma, and he had ties throughout the Oklahoma, Missouri, and Arkansas area. That's not necessarily unusual because we are right in that corner, but he was doing stuff throughout this area.
What kind of stuff?
Well, you know, like the drug trafficking and assaults and that kind of thing. On November 12th, 2021, he was charged with driving with a revoked or suspended license. In the grand scheme of things for him, that's like a pretty minor offense. But it does explain why on November 15th, just 3 days later, he was using a scooter to get around. So At 8:30 in the morning on November 15th, 2021, he was southbound on Highway 71 near Jane, Missouri, when he attempted to make a U-turn and crossed into the path of a Chrysler 300. He did not survive this accident.
So he got killed on his scooter?
Yeah, because his license.
And this was quite recently.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
This man had actually been a suspect in Shauna's murder for years. It just wasn't publicly known. In 2004, a letter came across Detective Lori Howard's desk. Now, this is a full 4 years before Detective Howard learns about and starts working on Shauna's case / the Grace Doe case. This letter starts off saying that the writer wants to tell them something about this man. It then goes on to detail the horrifying death of a young woman. This letter was signed. Now, at the time, Lori Howard didn't know about Shauna's case. In 2008, she starts working on the case of an unidentified woman named Grace Doe. And even then, it's not necessarily clear that she's the woman referenced in that letter. But later, as the pieces come together, it becomes apparent that the woman referenced in this letter and her murder was Grace Doe / Shauna.
Did the letter come from the killer?
No, so it came from a witness.
Okay.
And it said, I want to tell you what this man did. And it named him.
How did the witness know?
The witness was a witness.
The witness saw all of this?
Yes.
And waited that long to speak up?
Yes. So, yeah, I know.
What?
Well, let me get into it.
Okay, get into it. Because now I'm like, meh.
Yeah. So at the time, though, like, the pieces aren't all coming together. So in the years that follow, Lori Howard and Rhonda Wise do pursue other angles. In our episode, we did talk about the killer, you know, known as BTK, because he kept coming up as a possibility due to general proximity and the fact that she was bound. And this was, again, all over the news last year, but investigators even then were pushing back on it. And I think I said in that episode that I was bringing it up because A, it's clear that investigations and investigators weren't done with BTK's crimes,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's still an ongoing situation. And B, because Shauna kept on being mentioned in the media as connected to him, and it had to be addressed in some way. It turns out that the detectives had spoken to BTK along with another suspected serial killer, but they kept coming back to their local suspect. Throughout the years, investigators questioned this witness to Shauna's murder over and over. This happens in 2010, 2015, and 2017. This witness was a minor when the murder happened and witnessed the crime, but she was too afraid to provide more information. It's only now, well after the killer's death, that witnesses have felt comfortable coming forward. They now have six different witnesses who independently share their stories, and these stories line up with the evidence and corroborate one another. There is also information that was given by witnesses that wasn't released to the general public.
Do we know why that witness was there if they were a minor at the time?
They are keeping everything very closed down in terms of the witnesses. It's very clear that the witnesses are still afraid. Even after his death.
Really? So this was, it's like, we always talk about this, how like something like this can impact so many lives. Mm-hmm. And it seems like those witnesses probably never had a normal life because of this also.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so a lot of them are carrying around this secret information and also fearing what happens when they share it. Lori Howard says of this process with the witnesses, the problem you'd run up against in years past is nobody really wanted to go on the record when he was alive. They weren't comfortable saying what he did. They would give us information, but never enough to go forward with the prosecution. Lori Howard says that she did go and speak to him before he died in his accident, and she'd gone to his house, and she said this of this exchange. I went to his house and said to him, before you die, I want to be your last phone call, because I want to know what happened to her. And in response, she said he laughed and he smiled. And then Lori says, that was pretty much the extent of what I got from him verbally.
Laughs and smiles? How would you feel if you were her? You would want to just, like, punch him in the face.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could be, like, as controlled as she was and just be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, she's on Tough Lady.
Right, but it must have been so difficult for her.
Yeah, so she can't in her position do anything, so she just has to, like...
Right. I mean, obviously you can't go around punching people, but it would make you want to.
Yes.
And I would probably cry because I can't.
Right.
So I would not be a good investigator.
No. I mean, Laurie Howard is an exceptional investigator on this. In the end, Laurie Howard says this, the letter itself is extremely important, but it doesn't stand alone. It's the letter, it's the sources, it's the facts, it's the left out information, it's the corroboration, it's the witnesses, it's the vehicle, it's finally. All of these pieces were put together to confirm that he is the right guy. She said, I know he has family and people who love him, but he should have had to pay for what he did. Maybe he is, I don't know, but we did get the right guy.
Do we know if he killed other people?
There is some conversation about that with him, and I'll get into kind of the pieces of that.
Okay.
Because that brings us to what is next for Shauna's case and for him. If he had still been alive, her killer would have faced murder charges, and with his death, obviously, that's not possible. Shauna's case is being kept open so that the investigators can still pursue the possibility that other people were involved in her case, and so that the witnesses' names can continue to be kept private. Again, though he is dead, some of those witnesses still fear retribution for the information that they have shared from other people, it sounds like.
Okay.
The other question is whether there's a possibility that Shauna's killer could have been involved in crimes, right? So, yes, that is a conversation that is happening. Sheriff Robert Evanson, though, said very clearly, we're not there yet. Like, they've just gotten to this point, right?
Give them time.
And now, because I know someone will bring this up and we'll probably get someone to ask, investigators were indeed asked specifically about whether or not there's a possibility that he could be involved in the disappearance of Loria Bible and Ashley Freeman. Vanessa, I'm guessing you don't know about this case at all.
No.
So if you don't know, like Vanessa doesn't, this is two teenagers who went missing in Oklahoma in 1999 following the double murder of Ashley's parents and the burning of their trailer. They answered, investigators did, that yes, he had been looked at by other agencies for this case. But again, I want to make clear that that doesn't mean anything, and it doesn't mean anything more than like that, that they're not saying he did it. It's just, yes, they have considered that as a possibility, and to do anything more enters into the world of like speculation, which I do not like. As for Shauna's family, they now know a lot more about what happened to her, but there's still a lot missing. For one, we, along with investigators and members of the media, still share the artist rendering of Shauna. That's because there are no known pictures of Shauna past a few from her early childhood. And Vanessa, I know as a photographer, you've encountered this with others in the past where photos just are non-existent.
Yeah, it's really sad. And sometimes we're the ones who have to kind of like isolate someone from a photo so that we can create those photos that aren't there.
Right.
And it's never a fun thing to do, but it always feels good to be able to provide that.
Right. And so they don't have any record past those early years for her. What the family is hoping for now is more information about Shauna's childhood and early adulthood before her murder and pictures of her from that time. Now, again, her birth name was Shauna Beth Garber, but her name was legally changed to Shauna Robin Harvey when she was a child. She was born in 1968. She has connections within the Kansas area as well as Oklahoma and Missouri. So particularly if you know anyone in these areas, please share out information about Shauna and try to use her name that she was using in life, which was Shauna Robin Harvey, because that's likely what people would have recognized her as. Detective Laurie Howard said, once I found out who she was and the tragedy of her life, she was just invisible. So I found myself constantly reassuring her, I won't let you down. You won't stay invisible. People will know that your life was hard. One of the most meaningful things that detectives and Shauna's family can have are stories and photos of her. And I know someone somewhere must have those. So that's my message now about her case. Her family deserves that, and Shauna does too.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, In the Cursed Country, read by Terrell Rothery. Terrell Rothery is a Canadian actor of stage, television, and film. She is best known for her portrayal of Dr. Janet Frazier on Showtime's Stargate SG-1 and her starring role in the Hallmark Channel original series Cedar Cove. Rothery can most recently be seen in Upload and Virgin River. She has been in a number of television movies, Hallmark movies, and mysteries. Terrell is also a certified intuitive coach and clinical hypnotherapist.
In the Cursed Country, unidentified woman discovered December 2nd, 1990, in McDonald County, Missouri. Title from a line by Joy Harjo. Who we are is not tethered cords or the way our skin reflects winter light. We are grace, because memory is a parachute that falls quickly until it lights with a flame match. Grace in that the fox knows the way to worry bone, breaking it open to the soft marrow. Grace in a land that remembers it kneels to yield to coming frost, that preserver of death. Grace in a woman who never forgets how to carry the weight of another human home again.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast, Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcast, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence. And give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.